The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, Patrick Cox here. And English belongs to everybody, right? It's an open source language. No one, no government body tells you what you can say and what you can't. There's no English Academy. But it's not that simple. There are hierarchies, like it or not. There is, as many people insist, there is a standard English, or several, depending on where in the world you are. Standard English in India is very different from standard English in Canada, say. But you know what I mean. There are sort of accepted ways of expressing yourself, especially when you write. If you do it that way, if you toe the line, you're going to score higher in exams, you're going to get a good job, generally get ahead in life. But who am I kidding? That's not the only way we express ourselves. People don't talk the way they write an exam essay. Not at home, not with friends. And how you speak depends on where you are, right? From Sydney to Nairobi to Glasgow to New York, there's a ton of different spoken vernaculars. New York, just in the five boroughs. Just think of the varieties of spoken Englishes there. Now, some writers, fiction writers mainly, they see it as their duty to recreate their own spoken version of English on the page, to capture it and convey it to a larger audience that may never have been exposed to it before. Mainly, they tell original stories, but they also sometimes translate stories, the Bible in Jamaican patois, Don Quixote in Spanglish, that kind of thing. In fact, we asked a few writers to translate into their own vernaculars the opening lines of Dickens's David Copperfield. I'll play them in full later in the pod, but here's a taste.
David Copperfield, Chapter 1, I Am Born. Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life...
But whether that station will be held by another guy, go get him inside these pages.
Me start my life with the beginning of my life. Me write some did born. I saw them tell me, and I saw me believe, upon a Friday.
Se ha remarcado que el reloj began to strike.
As the clock starts strike, the hour is cry, I start crying.
That last voice belongs to M. Norbese Philip. She's written novels and plays and poems, many of them in the vernacular of the Caribbean islands of Trinidad and Tobago, where she grew up. Here she is talking with The Big Show's Marco Werman.
When we write in standard English, we don't write the same way we speak. So the writer is putting it through a process to convey an impression that when someone reads it, it sounds like somebody speaking. That's in standard English. So the same thing happens, I have found, when I work with the vernacular or dialect or patois, whatever we call it, that you can't write it exactly, at least I don't, exactly as the person speaks it. You have to put it through a certain process that conveys the impression that it is being said in the vernacular or the dialect or patois.
For you, what is the motivation to writing in vernacular English as opposed to, quote unquote, standard English?
Well, I work in both. And I have an essay I wrote over 2 decades ago called The Absence of Writing or How I Almost Became a Spy. And one of the things that I argue in that essay is that as people from the Caribbean, we inhabit a spectrum of language. And you actually hear it when you go into the cultures. You can hear somebody, they call it code switching. You might start off saying something in standard English and midway switch into the dialect or the vernacular. And I think because of the history and how English and the other European languages were brought to us, we inhabit the spectrum. At the one end, you have what, when I grew up, was called bad English. Today, it's called patois, demotic, nation language. At the other end, we have received pronunciation, standard English. And I think we inhabit that. As a writer, I want to be able and claim to be able to use all the resources of the language. I think young people need to know that when they go for jobs and so on, that, you know, they have to be able to articulate in a certain way, you know, the standard English. But certainly, it's such a rich resource to get to your question. There's so much energy in it. There's so much life in it that if you can really work it on the page, I think it's incredibly vibrant.
Are the prompts the same for code switching in writing as they are in kind of vernacular conversation?
I think in writing, you're in a much more controlled situation. So, for instance, I'm thinking of my book, Harriet's Daughter, in which I have, you know, the spectrum of language, not just standard English and vernacular, but also Black American English. You have more control, and so you can maybe control what's going on. But for instance, in conversation, I might be talking to somebody who might not, say, be highly educated, but very intelligent and so on. So I might start off saying something in standard English and then switch into something that they would get. But I think in writing, you're really controlling it. And what I say about fiction in particular is that, you know, you're using artifice to make it seem like the truth. Do you know?
Which leads me to my next question. Who gets the right to write in vernacular? For example, Mark Twain writing in African-American vernacular. Is that any different from, say, you writing in African-American dialect as a Tobagan? Or like Quentin Tarantino writing in African-American dialect?
I think that we can't set up these rules about who has the right to do it and not the right to do it. So again, let's take the Caribbean. You have Europeans, you have South Asians, you have Africans, people from all backgrounds. And if they grow up speaking the language and being in touch with the language and can use it, and for me, the better way to come at it would be to say when it's done, then the reviewer or the people reading it can assess it to say, you know what, this doesn't work. This doesn't seem authentic. So for me, it's not so much a right, because that gets into making rules and laws that really we can't enforce.
Would you say it's the same answer to the question, does this belong to anybody?
It's not so much a matter of whether it belongs to anybody. It's certainly, I mean, there are certain things that are part of people's cultural heritage, you know? So I think, for instance, the Jamaican patois is certainly a rich resource and part of the Jamaican matrimony and patrimony sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's part of their culture. I wouldn't say it belongs to them. I would say they own it. You may have, I went to a comedy show, there was in Toronto, there was this white Canadian who lived in an area, so he picked up patois and he had us in stitches. He had the intonation, he had it down, and that was fine. And so that's how I tend to think of it. Certain groups, when I say own it, in the sense that it is part of their legacy, part of their heritage. And remember, I have to say that this is a legacy that comes from a deep historical trauma of people not being allowed to use their own languages and then weren't even being taught the best way to use those European languages. And I think it's a marvelous resource that those ancestors were able to wrest out of something that was so tragic.
Norbert A. Philip, thank you very much for coming in.
It was a deep pleasure to talk with you.
And interesting that Philip didn't want to be drawn into saying who should and who shouldn't use the vernacular. There is, of course, a pretty shameful history of people, outsiders, using local vernacular or some forms of them, accents, music, to demean the people who speak in that vernacular. I say a history of this, but it's still going on.
Oh yes, when we take charge and the new prime minister is Farage, we can't...
This is Mike Reed, a former radio DJ, a white English guy, who happens now to be an activist with UKIP, an anti-immigration political party in Britain. He sings this song at UKIP events. Listen to the lyrics.
Leaders committed a cardinal sin. Open the borders, let them all come in. Illegal immigrants in every town. Stand up and be counted, Blair and Brown. Oh, yes.
Not surprisingly, this song was called Racist. And Mike Reed was criticized for putting those sentiments to Calypso music with a fake Caribbean accent. Again, not very surprising. He has apologized. It's an example of what Dora Ahmad might call musical blackface. And Dora has come across plenty of the written equivalent of musical blackface, literary blackface. As a subgenre, let's hope it's dying out. Dora Ahmad's specialty is vernacular literature, which she teaches at St. John's University. And she's the editor of a great anthology called Rotten English. Long-time listeners to the pod, and I really mean long time, you may recall a conversation I had with Dora back in 2008. Yes, that long ago. Well, we thought it was time to talk with Dora again. Here she is on what makes vernacular writing, in some sense, a contradiction.
If you think about the term vernacular literature, it doesn't make any sense. It's an oxymoron because a literature is written down, or at least we associate it with something written down, even though we talk about oral literatures, and a vernacular isn't. So there's this really interesting paradox going on where you're taking something that's in flux, that's constantly changing, and that people don't expect to see written down, and you're making it codified. So what all of these writers are doing is taking something and fixing it and sending it out for a wider audience. So that's kind of one of the invigorating paradoxes of vernacular literature, is that it doesn't actually make any sense. It's oral and written at the same time. It's in flux and it's fixed at the same time.
A contradiction it may be, but it's an increasingly popular way to write.
Starting in around the 1980s and 1990s, there was just an explosion of vernacular literature. So there's Roddy Doyle in Ireland, Irvine Welsh in Scotland, James Kelman as well in Scotland, people writing in Nigeria, Papua New Guinea, New Zealand, Canada, Jamaica, Trinidad. But then when I started researching, I realized that, in fact, this is something that's been going on since the time of Chaucer. We're just in one particular vernacular renaissance now. But really, even somebody like Dante choosing to write in Italian, in the Vulgate, in the language of the people, instead of in Latin, that was that same type of vernacular revolution. And things that we think of as standard English. So Shakespeare is, you know, probably the most canonical writer, but he was writing in a vernacular in his own time. So it's something that we see kind of ebbing and flowing. A vernacular will get written down, it'll become codified, it'll become canonized, and then we don't think of it as a vernacular anymore, but when we go back to those roots, it's really a similar phenomenon.
So what about spelling and punctuation? No rules? Well, yes, there are rules, but they're dictated by the writer.
If you take the word ain't, for example, do you spell it A-I-N apostrophe T or do you spell it A-A-N-T? It's something that any student will recognize as that's going to get the red pen if you write it in an essay. But you can see it in literature all over the place. And that punctuation mark, what that means is an omission. That means a letter that's been left out. But if you spell it without that, then it's really a new word. So you can start to look at an individual author and see the difference between, for example, 19th century dialect literature, somebody like Joel Chandler Harris or Charles Chestnut. There are just apostrophes all over the place, and those all mean letters have been left out, something's wrong. This is a dialect that departs from the standard. And then what you see with the later 20th century writers is a lot of people just writing without that apostrophe, without anything being left out, really getting a flow. Does it act like a new language or does it act like a lesser version of something else? And we're just seeing all of these writers proclaiming proudly, this is it, this is what I speak, this is what you need to listen to, this is what you can learn if you read my writing.
I don't even want to tell you where we're at. We're in Casa de Campo, the resort that shame forgot.
This is Dominican-American writer Juno Diaz reading from one of the stories from his collection, This Is How to Lose Her.
It's the largest, wealthiest resort on the island, which means it's a goddamn fortress walled away from everybody else, with guachimanes and peacocks and ambitious topiaries everywhere. Advertises itself in the States as its own country, and it might as well be. Has its own airport, 36 holes of golf, and beaches so white they ache to be trampled, and the only island Dominicans that you'll see are guaranteed to either be caked up with money or changing your sheets. Let's just say that my abuelo has never been here, and neither has yours.
That excerpt, by the way, came via the WGBH Forum Network. It was at an event presented by the Harvard Bookstore and Boston Review. And as a writer who uses the vernacular, Diaz does so sparingly. It comes across as much in the rhythm as in the words. Okay, now the opening to David Copperfield in several vernaculars. First, the opening lines are read in Dickens's English, by the Big Show's Jonathan Dyer.
Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike, and I began to cry simultaneously. In consideration of the day and hour of my birth, it was declared by the nurse, and by some sage women in the neighbourhood, who'd taken a lively interest in me several months before there was any possibility of our becoming personally acquainted, first, that I was destined to be unlucky in life, and secondly, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits, both these gifts inevitably attaching, as they believed, to all unlucky infants of either gender born towards the small hours on a Friday night.
My name is Stacey Ann Chin. I'm a poet, an activist, a writer, a mother, a resident of New York City. Whether me go end up the hero of my own life, whether that position go be for somebody else, them page I have to show that. Me start my life with the beginning of my life. Me write some of it born. I saw them tell me, and I saw me believe, upon a Friday, 12 o'clock at night. Them say the clock start strike, and me start ball at the exact same time. Because of the day and the hour of my birth, the nurse and some other woman in the district who did take a serious interest in me quite a few months before anybody did know them going to have a chance to meet me, declare, one, me now go have no luck in my life, and two, that me go have powers for Sidopi and spirit. Them two things must bound for true. So them believe, for all bad luck baby, boy or girl, who born in them small hours upon a Friday night.
David Copperfield, Fragment, trasladado al Spanglish by Ilan Stavans. Sea que haya al convertirme en un hero de mi propia vida, o sea que dar condición will be tomada by alguien distinto, estas páginas must demostrarlo. Para empezar mi vida desde el beginning de mi vida, ahí establezco que ahí nací, as I have been informado and I creo, en un viernes a las 12 of the noche. Se ha remarcado que el reloj began to strike y que yo began to llorar simultaneously. En consideración del día y hour of my nacimiento, it was declarado by the nurse y por some mujeres sabias del hood que had taken un lively interest in me several meses antes que there was alguna possibility de conocernos personally, primero que estaba destinado a ser unlucky en la vida. Y segundo, que yo era privilegiado de ver ghosts y espíritus. Estos dos regalos eran atacheados, ellos believed, a los unlucky infantes de los dos genders, born hacia las pequeñas horas del viernes in the noche.
This is Lee Tonouchi, also known as the Pigeon Gorilla. I'm one pigeon rider from Hawaii. Whether I turn off will be the hero of my own life, or whether that station gonna be held by another guy, gonna get him inside these pages. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I stay recording that I was born as I was informed and believe. On Friday, 12 o'clock, night time, bruh. Was even remarked that when the clock would begin for strike, I would begin for cry, same time, yups. In the consideration of the day and hour of my birth, was declared by the nurse and by some Akamai Wahine in the neighborhood who would go take one lively interest in me several months before I had any possibilities of us coming personally acquainted. First, that I was destined for being unlucky in life. And second, that I was privileged to see ghosts and obake. Both these gifts inevitably attaching, they will go believe, to all the unlucky babies, boy, girl, no matter, born on top on Friday night towards the hours of small kind.
Okay, that's it for this time. The producers of today's pod were Susie Blair and Nina Polzuki, who's the editor of our translation series, In Other Words. There's more at pri.org/language and at the World in Words Facebook page. Don't forget to check out all the other great Soundworks podcasts. Go to soundworks.org. And last thing, I'm on Twitter, tweeting like a starved sparrow or something like that. My Twitter handle is Patricox, PATRICOX. See you next time. As we progress to the checkpoint, I wholeheartedly agree with your viewpoint, but this ain't your typical garage joint. I make points which hold significance. That ain't a bag, it's a shipment. This ain't a track, it's a movement. I got the settlement. My frequencies are transient and resonate your eardrums. I make bangers, not anthems. Leave that to the Artful Dodger. The broad-shouldered 51% shareholder. You won't find us on Alta Vista. Cult classic, not bestseller. You're gonna need
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.